Hello, this is Richard Deitch, and welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast, where each week we interview a member of the sports media. This week, we're going a little outside the box. Our guest is David Fahrenthold. He is a reporter for the Washington Post, and you have most notably seen his reporting on Donald Trump's charitable giving. I asked David about the reporting of the Access Hollywood video, how they verified the authenticity of the video, and what it was like knowing that the Post had this big a story.
I knew that was going to be big. I didn't know it was going to be as big as it was. But certainly, even with Trump, who has pushed the boundaries so far, this was beyond what he had done previously.
Naturally, a big part of the conversation, I asked David about looking into Donald Trump's charitable giving. He takes you through step by step how he has reported what has been an absolutely big and fascinating story.
I got into it because I liked the fact that there was somebody you could call who would know whether Donald Trump had told the truth. Only he knew his net worth. Only he knew what his taxes said. So here was a chance to find somebody who was not Donald Trump who could actually tell you if Trump was telling the truth about something.
And now, my conversation with David Fahrenthold, reporter for The Washington Post. Okay, and as promised, we bring in David Fahrenthold from The Washington Post. Very excited, first of all, to have David as part of the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast, the first non-sports media guest. Also, perhaps even bigger, David, is you were bumped yesterday for Jerry West. So you now have a story that you can tell your family and friends that you were once on a podcast where you were bumped, not even for my podcast, but for another podcast that tapes here, bumped for the logo of the NBA. So welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Thank you.
Before we get into your reporting, which has really been remarkable during this campaign. You are, as some of your colleagues have told me, a huge Astros fan.
That's
so,
right.
So I know that you you follow that team. You obviously read up on them, you know, from Altuve to Correa, Springer. This is a really good team. And even though took a step back this year, the team is really set up for the future. But I'm interested to know, if you could, before we get into your work, could you give me a sense of your sports media consumption on a daily and weekly level, and what do you consider trusted sports media sources?
That's interesting. You know, I read a lot of Post, you know, Washington Post coverage. I have been following the Nationals a lot since I've been here. I hate the Redskins. Don't really care about the other teams in the D.C. area, but read a lot of our Nationals coverage. And then I read a lot of I get SI. I read SI sometimes, not so much in the last few weeks. And read a lot of ESPN, but I'm now like a passive TV watching sports fan more than I am a reading sports fan since this campaign began, just because I feel like every moment I should be reading something about Donald Trump.
I can understand that. You know, you're at a newspaper, whether it's Tom Boswell or Sally Jenkins, Dave Shinen, it's really one of the best sports sections in the country. When you are reading their coverage, David, do you see parallels at all between political reporting and sports reporting?
I do, certainly. I think there's a little bit less of that parallel now than there used to be. I'll tell you why. I feel like for a long time, political reporting had been accepted like sports reporting, in that you would go to different venues, but the players would be the same, and the stakes would never seem that high. I mean, the stakes of covering a particular playoff game or even a Super Bowl are not that great in the grand scheme of things. It's still something that, sort of a show that you watch and you report on the outcome. I think it's how a lot of people viewed political reporting going into this year. Like, it didn't really matter which team won, things are going to be about the same as they were, and that everybody sort of accepted the kind of rules of the game. I think what's been interesting about covering Trump is that he has sort of kind of rejected in some ways the rules about how to act, how to, you know, how to be truthful, how to deal with times when he wasn't truthful, and especially the way he's dealt with the actual events. Covering a political rally used to be sort of like covering a baseball game. You showed up, doesn't matter who you were, you knew there was going to be, you were going to be well taken care of as a reporter. It was going to be a safe environment. You were going to watch it, comment on what happened and leave. And this year, the transition from that environment to a political environment at Trump's rallies, where reporters actually are escorted in by the cops, screamed at by the fans, by the attendees, and focused on in a negative way by the person at the front of the room, it's made that experience very different than it was even 4 years ago.
Yeah, that's interesting. And you've seen a lot of the reporters who, and I certainly follow a lot of the reporters who cover the campaign, and some of the things, especially lately, they've tweeted out, very scary. I mean, it just seems like a very, it's a powder keg kind of environment, and you sort of fear that something bad, and God hope it doesn't happen, but something bad can happen. One more thing on this, and then I want to get into your reporting. And that is, one of the things about sports reporting, David, is that columnists in particular are sort of given the leeway of morphing between reportage and opinion and what people sort of think of traditional objective journalism. And I feel even your traditional beat reporter in different cities for sports, that line is now morphed, especially if you're working online. You see a lot of traditional beat reporters, they will offer opinion or commentary either on the web or on Twitter. Have you, especially in this election, which is so polarizing and so opinion-driven, have you seen more political reporting sort of morph away from the what we think of traditional journalism and morphed into some kind of hybrid of reportage, commentary, opinion, and traditional journalism?
The main thing that I've seen this year, actually, has sort of been a different shift, which is, I think in the past there was a lot of sort of theater criticism in political reporting. People would write about whatever had gone on that day and kind of give you as part of the news story would be, you know, did Romney do a good job of driving at the theme he hit for that day? Did he appear relatable? A lot of political reporting was sort of criticism of optics and behavior, the behavior of the candidate. But what's been interesting this year has been the appearance of what's moved into those traditional lead all main political news stories is fact checking. That used to be sort of a separate thing. There'd be a fact checker column or a fact checker feature on the website. But now, especially because of Trump, but because of Clinton too, there's much more in those daily main bar news stories of, you know, candidate X said this, that is not true. Here's an explanation of why. I feel like that's been the main thing I've seen that's changed. And so that is having an opinion. That is often, you know, a reporter saying, you know, expressing a conclusion. This thing that candidate X said is false. That's been the way that I think political reporting has changed this year, and there's been less focus relatively on the optics of one thing or another.
Do you want to answer the question of do the Astros most need a pitcher, catcher, or a corner outfielder before we get into politics?
I mean, I thought before this year pitching was the pitching situation was safe, but I after Keuchel didn't pitch so well this year, I think pitcher would be my answer.
Yeah, 9-12 with a 4.55 ERA after what was an incredible year last year, but that lineup is so potent. I think you're
so young.
Yeah, and so young. You're one pitcher. I feel like you're one pitcher away, and maybe a corner outfielder away from really being maybe the best team in the National League, assuming Gattis and Castro are your catchers. But all right,
both those guys have sort of flaws, but Gattis actually played better than I thought this year.
He did. Yeah, he's got a lot of power. All right, we'll get to that in the end. All right, let's pause for a second with my conversation with David Farenthold to talk about Uber. We've all taken jobs to earn extra cash. And back in the day, I worked at a Taco Bell, worked at a deli, worked at a paint store. Not many of those jobs particularly I worked at for long, but I did do all those jobs. And listen, you need extra money, especially at certain times of your life. And I have a better way that you can earn extra money on the side. Much easier today, thanks to Uber. Uber's the ultimate side hustle. Driving with Uber is a new way you can earn extra cash whenever you want. It's not just another job. It's a total flexible way to earn money. You can turn it on and off just like you turn your car on and off. If you have a few spare hours here and there, you can drive with Uber. Also, have you ever wanted to be your own boss? You'd probably make a great boss for yourself. If you drive with Uber, you are your own boss. Whether you're in a big city or a small city, you've likely taken Uber. One of the great inventions, by the way, of the 21st century. So if you're driving right now, you should be earning right now with Uber. Every day is a payday when you drive with Uber because you can cash out anytime you want with Instant Pay. With access to Instant Pay, cash out your earnings up to 5 times a day with no minimum account required. So listen, if you enjoy earning extra cash, if there's something special you'd like to buy, your car can start to make you some money. Go ahead, get your side hustle on. Sign up to drive with Uber today. Go to uber.com/drive now. That's uber.com/drive now. uber.com/drive now. Go join Uber and drive today. All right, now let's go back to our conversation with the Washington Post's David Farenthold. I want to start off with the Access Hollywood story because this, you can make the argument, the biggest story of the political season and really fascinating how it came to be. I read the Paul Farhi story in the Washington Post, an excellent media reporter, about how the Access Hollywood tape became a story in the Post. You got a phone call around 11 a.m. on a Friday from a source with a tip about Donald Trump. The source asks you, would you be interested in seeing some previously unaired video of Trump? There's a lot of young journalists who listen to this podcast, so I want to get into the process as much as I can with you and as obviously as much as you can go. Where were you when this call came?
Just at my desk.
Okay. Did the source send you either a video or an audio copy of the tape?
A video copy.
A video copy of the tape. When you first saw it, what was your initial reaction when after you viewed whatever the 3 minutes of the tape was?
I had been, you know, the source had given a little bit of a preview about what was in it, but I was really shocked and surprised, actually. I mean, I feel like we've heard Trump talking. We've heard his voice for, you know, 2 years now, or almost 2 years. And you've heard him say shocking things before on the Howard Stern show. I heard him sort of, you know, talk in a kind of raunchy way about women. But this was just so different. I mean, this was him being so vulgar, first of all, in the words that he used, but also so direct about what he himself had done. The past stuff had been sort of him appraising women's bodies, or him saying, you know, I could have got with Princess Di or whatever, but like sort of talking hypothetically. Now he's talking about things that he did, he does, he will do again. And that thing at the end where you can actually hear the Tic Tacs rattling around. He says, well, you know, I'm going to put this in because I just started kissing women. I knew that was going to be big. I didn't know it was going to be as big as it was, but certainly even with Trump, who has pushed the boundaries so far, this was beyond what he had done previously.
So in that position, David, when you get this kind of tip, and even if you don't think it's going to be as big as it was, you obviously know it's a huge story. Do you bring in a group of people around you to sort of ascertain, all right, here's what we have here, here's my game plan? I'm curious to know, how long are you sort of doing this solo until you're bringing others at the Post in?
Not very long. So I went and kind of rang the alarm bells and found, you know, the national editor and found the video people and found the politics editor. And, you know, we have a really good video team here at the Post, and they actually, which is great, because they really understood sort of the legal questions that had to be asked about a video particularly. I feel like, you know, I understand something about legal questions involving stories, but, you know, the rights issues, could we use this? You know, what part of it could we use? And they kind of, so the video team really picked up and ran with the ball quite a bit. So one of their folks actually transcribed the relevant part of the video, like the first minute and a half. They talked to the lawyers about, you know, what we needed, the questions we needed to answer, the things we needed to ask NBC. So that was like a whole parallel operation, which made it a lot easier. I wasn't having to do those things and transcribe the video. But then we got to the question of, you know, who do we check with? When do we call them? What do we show them,
right,
you know, to make sure that we verify this is true?
That's my next question, because I think a lot of listeners would want to know the process. So how do you verify the authenticity of this video? How do you prove that it is indeed the people you think are on this tape are on this tape?
Well, I had more confidence that, you know, the beginning of the video, the part that everyone's heard and that is so interesting, is the part where Trump and Billy Bush are heard but not seen. They're on the bus. You can hear them, but you can only see the bus. But then you see the video, thankfully. The video continues, and you see them get off the bus. So there's some confidence this is not totally concocted. But we knew we had to go to Trump's people, and we knew we had to go to NBC, because it was obviously NBC's footage to begin with. So I had reached out to NBC and to Billy Bush's flack and to the Trump people. And the NBC people basically didn't respond at all. They didn't respond on the record. But that was their chance to say, oh, my God, this is fake, or if you use this, we'll sue you, or, you know, something else. And they didn't. They chose basically not to respond on the record. Trump's people got back to us. So we got the video about 11 a.m., a little after 11. It was noon, we'd reached out to all these people. The Trump people's response was I just sent them a transcript. I sent them a transcript of the raunchy part.
Interesting.
And they said, well, it doesn't sound like Mr. Trump. Can you send us the video, the full video? And there was a lot of debate here about when we should send it to them and how, you know, should we just send them the audio file? Should we send them the whole thing? And Marty Baron, our executive editor, said, no, just send them the whole video. So we did, and after seeing it, then changed their mind and said, oh, yes, it is him. He did say that, you know, and he apologizes if anybody was offended.
Interesting. This is one of the things that I talked about with some of my Sports Illustrated colleagues, which I absolutely found fascinating, and I imagine you did too. It must have been kind of thrilling to be in that newsroom. As part of the reporting, you just mentioned, you have to call NBC and Access Hollywood. You have to reach out to Billy Bush. You obviously reach out to the Trump campaign. Once you do that, David, you know now that you are tipping NBC off that you have this story that should be meaningful to them because they are a news organization. So how did you guys sort of game plan this? Because you're always in this situation if you're contacting a news organization. Once you alert them that you have a story that they would be interested in, the clock is ticking now to beat them. So that was a fascinating part of this for me. I was thinking, well, how did David approach that? And did you have like a internal clock where it's like, okay, by 4 o'clock, no matter what, I'm going with this because I think NBC could get to it by then.
Yeah, sure. We thought just logistically the earliest we could get it up would be about 3:30, just given all the lawyering and other things that had to go on. And so I reached out to NBC around noon, I think. And, yes, obviously there was a real concern they were going to beat us to this. But, on the other hand, I didn't want to go. The lawyers were very concerned that they would say, that they would sue us for using their video, or that they would say that it was a hoax and it wasn't real. So I wanted to give them as much of a chance as I could. And I knew, yeah, there was a chance they'd beat me to it. But, that was sort of the risk that we took. So we got to, 3:30, which is when we were ready to go. And then the question was, the last piece was the Trump piece. What Trump's people saying they wanted to see the video, and then they wanted some time to review the video. And so we had told them, look, we're going to do this at 4. You've seen the video. You have a chance to comment. This is going to go at 4 because we really did not want to get scooped by NBC. And, we were ready to hit the button without the Trump people. And then literally as the editor was walking back to her desk to hit the button to publish it, the Trump people called and gave us that statement. So we got that in right at the last minute. It would have gone without them, but it was good to have it in there. It was quite unusual to have Trump admitting to something like that. And I was glad that it came so fast.
Yeah. Obviously, this is a story, David, where you have to just, sort of rip and run, as they say in the trade. Like, this is not one where you can craft, at least in my parlance, Gary Smith style. So did you feel any kind of pressure as you were writing this that, like, I sort of just have to write what the facts are here? I can't necessarily craft this story the way I might have if I had 5 weeks, 5 months to really do like a beautifully written narrative.
Yeah, I mean, thankfully for me, there was not much, not much gilding that the story needed. And the transcript of the video was basically the meat of the story. So the two things that slowed, that were the hardest parts were, the context of, how should we put in there, what should we say about what Trump has said in the past about women, and how he's defended himself, how this is different. So there was a little bit of that, context, explanations he'd given in the past saying, in the past he said, well, I said that stuff on Howard Stern, but I was just saying it to be an entertainer. I was just saying it, to play a character. And, the contrast with this is a private moment. And then also there were so many curse words in that story. There were so many of the words you can't say on television.
Right.
But we at the Post have, general guidelines for that thing, but it's rare that you get a story that you would use that many expletives in one story. And it turns out that the rules are very amorphous, where the editors were asking, what about this word? What about this word? How many, our normal style is the first letter and then dashes. But in a couple of these, we were like, well, if we just have P dash, 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 will people know what that is? Will people be able to guess? So that actually took a lot of time to figure out the logistics of how we handle all the different dirty words.
Yeah. And I think if I'm right about this, both you and the New York Times use the words in full, which I don't know if for the Post, it certainly felt like it broke some new ground in the New York Times.
They were bolder. They actually used the whole F word in their copy. And we had F dot dash, dash, dash. But, that was a lot of the wrangling, was trying to figure out what we could use.
What time did the story publish on the site?
4, okay. Like 4:02.
Okay, so it publishes at 4:02. And what are you doing between 4:02 and 4:12? The Post has its own mechanism. Story publishes. It's going on its Twitter feed. It's going on its Facebook feed. We now know how big the story is today when I'm taping this with you. But what are the first 10 minutes, 15 minutes like for you? Are you watching the website? Are you watching Twitter? Because it was pretty fascinating to see the immediate reaction. And it's more fascinating now in hindsight to know what that story ultimately became.
That's right. I mean, right afterward, I was trying to, promote it on my own Twitter feed to get other people to promote it, sort of reading it over again to make sure I got everything right. You're always seized with this moment of panic when the story goes out in the world and people start reading it. Oh, my God, did I transcribe it right? Or did I get the transcription right? But that was it. And then NBC published their version at like 4:10 or something like that. So they were up with theirs very quickly. So that's sort of, as a reporter, that's like the most ideal situation. You have this thing, Trump confirms it, and then you're not out so you get credit for being first, but you're not out on a limb for very long because NBC was right after us. It took off.
What was that night like for you? I don't remember. Were you on television at all? I imagine the request must have been coming fast and flying the next 2 days.
Yeah, definitely. The thing about this was, the earlier stories I've done this year, they were on charity and tax law. Like, if TV networks wanted to talk about it, they often wanted me to be there because, it's something that other people have a hard time commenting on. But this, like, they don't need me to explain why this is salacious or interesting or important. So some did have me on, but it was not the same. It was not only me. Everybody was talking about it, and only a few of them actually needed me to come talk about it.
I want to ask you this now as we're taping this October 18th, and now we're obviously a couple days after the fact. What has it been like for you to watch what this story has become in terms of a talking point across the country. It was used in a debate massively. I mean, even as of yesterday, Melania Trump gave an interview to CNN that it, the only reason that interview exists is because of the Access Hollywood story. So this story has had tentacles, David, as you know, that you can't even sort of begin to count. So what has it been like for you to see where this story has gone and where both political candidates have used this story?
Well, it is amazing. I mean, I've never had a story like this before where you could see, you know, that kind of influence over something as big as a presidential election. It's been very, gratifying in some sense that what you did made such a difference, but also really odd and new to see, you know, people talking about the tape now more than a week later and have it come up in a debate, you know, people sort of talking about it, how it moved polls. It was an odd thing for me because it obviously wasn't something that I had spent weeks and weeks on. Sometimes the story, you know, there's other stories where you work on it for weeks and you feel like a really strong sense of ownership over it. This one, it was in my hands for 5 hours before it got published. So it's even weirder to have a story that happened so fast have such a long tail.
For the non-journalists who listen to this podcast, David, I do want to ask you directly. You're not going to reveal your source here, correct?
No.
Okay. I think people would want to know why you will not reveal your source.
Just a promise. The source, that was a promise that the source requested, that nothing be revealed about where the tape had come from other than it came from a source, came from a person. But that, you know, that was the condition that I agreed to. So you have to honor that.
The last one before we get into, you know, the work that I think obviously people know you for, at least nationally at the moment, the work about Donald Trump's charitable giving. In hindsight, that particular day when the story broke, is there anything you, given hindsight now, that you would have done differently that day, or maybe you wish you had more time to do something different?
Well, the thing that I wish I'd had and tried to get and couldn't was to talk to the soap opera actress who was the sort of object of this.
Right.
So we knew her name. It took us a little while to figure out her name, and I got a hold of her publicist. But I had never really dealt with Hollywood folks before this election, and it is like a Byzantine world, an impenetrable world of publicists. So there are two people I was trying to get a hold of beyond Billy Bush, who I had a contact for. There's Ariane Zucker, who is the soap opera actress, and Nancy O'Dell, who's the other Access Hollywood host. That she's the woman, it's been later revealed by NBC, that Trump and Billy Bush were talking about at the beginning of the tape, where Trump says that he tried to seduce her, took her furniture shopping. So I'm trying to reach those two people's publicists. And in Hollywood, if you're a publicist, it's a huge mark of stain and dishonor if you actually pick up the phone and talk to a reporter. You
right.
have to have a receptionist
yep.
who will keep the reporters. And their job, it would be God, only in an emergency would they ever let a reporter speak directly to the publicist. So I have these people on the phone, and they're saying, well, you know, I don't really have the publicist here. He's traveling. And I am like, dear God, do you have any idea what's about to happen to you? Let me try to explain what's about to happen in the next few minutes to your client. They're about to be, you know, world famous. So, and it never got through to them. No matter what I did, I could not convince those publicists that this was actually an emergency or something interesting. And so I didn't get any response. Neither one of them, Odell or Ariane Zucker, had any response until the next week. I would have loved to be able to get their responses in it, because they're, you know, if you've seen the video, when they're Billy Bush and Trump are talking, and Trump says he just starts kissing women and groping them, and then they get off and they sort of make nice with this soap opera actress who's been waiting outside for them, taking time out of her day without really any idea what drama she's being part of. I would have loved to hear her response to it, but I couldn't.
Yeah,
I couldn't figure out a way how to do it.
We have since heard from both Nancy O'Dell and that actress as well. Spent 3 years for Sports Illustrated doing a magazine Q&A where I did a lot of celebrities. That is an insane world, David. You're honestly not missing much by by not being part of that, to be very blunt. Lastly, this is a direct result of his actions, but your reporting is what brought it to light. Were you surprised at the news yesterday to see that Billy Bush was terminated from NBC? You know, there's collateral damage doesn't feel like the right word, because Billy Bush, I think, has sort of he stepped into a making of his own. But do you have any thoughts on, at least in terms of one character in your story, the resolution, at least for the moment, has been played out?
Yeah, I did see that. And, you know, I don't know, it's hard for me to sort of know what moral judgment to cast on him, especially because Donald Trump, who certainly was the more vulgar one of the two, is still running for president. I mean, he still could get the highest job and, you know, the most powerful job in the world. Billy Bush can't host the third hour of the Today Show.
Right.
But, you know, I thought that I was not surprised, I have to say that. After the way that I came out and the way that Billy Bush sounded in that video, especially talking about two other, I mean, just to put it in the most craven business sense, talking about two other NBC employees, I'm not surprised to see that he was let go.
Yeah, same here. And I think if you are hosting or co-hosting a female-oriented or female-driven show with colleagues who are women, with media buyers who are, or it's not media buyers, but with advertisements geared towards women, with women as the majority of the audience, I think that was clear that that was a fait accompli. Let me, David, get to this. And this is, I think, what people, obviously, nationally, beyond Washington, have really taken interest in. You began looking into Donald Trump's charitable giving through his foundation after, and correct me if I'm wrong on any of these facts, after Trump held his fundraiser for veterans in Iowa in late January. That was a fundraiser where he said he raised $6 million or so, and he toured around Iowa and New Hampshire, gave out these novelty checks to local veterans groups. So am I correct that was him sort of going around Iowa and New Hampshire, is that what sort of keyed you off to look into this? Or is there was there something else about your interest in his sort of broader history of charity?
Well, I basically had not done, I didn't know anything about charity. I never covered charity or philanthropy or anything. And the year before this, I had really not covered Trump that much. I was kind of floating around from candidate to candidate and wrote a lot about people who candidates that we've all forgotten were even in this race, like Bobby Jindal. I spent like 3 weeks on a profile of Bobby Jindal. Yeah, so I had not really focused that much on Trump and especially hadn't focused on charity. But, you know, I was in Iowa, New Hampshire. So Trump holds that fundraiser for veterans January 28th in Iowa. And the next few days was the lead up to Iowa and then New Hampshire. And I was in both those states for sort of the final push. And I saw Trump at these rallies. You know, he'd bring people up and in the middle of his political rally, he'd stop and say, okay, you know, Waterloo, Iowa, you know, I'm going to bring up a local veterans group and I'm going to give them a check in the middle of the rally. And so the check says Donald J. Trump Foundation on the top. It's one of those big, like, Ed McMahon novelty checks. And the bottom says, Make America Great Again. Okay. And I don't know much about charity, but I know you can't do that. You can't use your charity to promote your political campaign. So that, I was interested in that for that reason, and also interested in it because he didn't give out $6 million. He said he raised $6 million. I saw him give out maybe $1 million, and then he stopped giving it out in the middle of those events. So I sort of came back to Washington after Iowa and New Hampshire, and I thought, well, I'll just call a few of these charities and make sure they really got the money, and then I'll call to try to figure out where the rest of the money went. It'll probably be a wild goose chase. It'll take me a day or two. And it was. It turned out that a lot of the groups he promised money to with the big checks at that point hadn't gotten any money, and I couldn't find anybody else who'd gotten the rest of the money, the other $5 million. And so I got into it because I liked the fact that there was somebody you could call who would know whether Donald Trump had told the truth. So much of the reporting about Trump to that point had been relying on Trump to tell you if he told the truth, and only he knew his net worth, only he knew what his taxes said. So here was a chance to find somebody who was not Donald Trump who could actually tell you if Trump was telling the truth about something. So I was drawn to that and sort of kept chasing it.
When do you know you're onto something? Like, when is it becoming clear that he's giving other people's money via his foundation rather than his own money?
What's interesting about this is I set off. So we had the whole Trump eventually gives away the $1 million of his own money that he promised to veterans. He gives it away only under pressure a few months later and calls me a nasty guy and has this big angry press conference where he gives away the rest of the money people had entrusted to him to give to veterans. And then I started looking for – here's what I thought the story was. I thought the story was, has Donald Trump given money out of his own pocket to charities in the last few years? Let's look for evidence that that was true. And so I started out looking for that and using the Trump Foundation, which, unlike his own personal taxes, we have the Trump Foundation's tax filing. So I knew who the Trump Foundation, which, as you said, is not his money. I knew what it had given its money to. And I thought, well, here's a roadmap. If I call these people that Trump gave other people's money to, maybe I'll find somebody that Trump gave his money to. And that's how I viewed the Trump Foundation in the beginning. And it was only later that I realized, actually, wait, the money, the Trump Foundation's donations are not just the roadmap to something else. There's something interesting in their own right, because I'm discovering time and time again where he spent the foundation's money in ways that basically broke the law.
How, at this point, as we tape this, how many charities have you contacted so far?
410.
And how many of those 410 have responded?
Almost, let's see, I would say probably about 350 have responded. You know, in terms of, some of them have responded and say no comment, but only, you know, maybe, 50 or maybe even less have just not responded at all. And I should say, the worst charities for that are athletes' charities.
Yeah, I want to get to
athletes
that.
And celebrities.
It's like fascinating to me. So I read that some of the non-responses include charities for Annika Sornstrom, obviously Hall of Fame golfer, Derek Jeter, Darryl Strawberry, former Major League Baseball players, former player Rodney Pete. Why do you think that is? Why have these athlete charities, for whatever reason, not responded to your inquiry?
I have no idea. So you're right. It is extremely disproportionate. The people who just, I call and call and call and they don't call back, are they're almost all athlete charities. And I think part of that is because they're often not very well run, that they're sort of shoestring operations. But a lot of them also depend on Trump's, a lot of those particular ones run charity golf tournaments at Trump's golf courses. So they're sort of business partners with Trump in an ongoing way. And maybe that's why they don't call back. I don't know. One thing I'm trying to figure out is how often Trump used the foundation's money to buy sort of sports memorabilia at these, you know, when a baseball player or somebody has their charity tournament at his course. And so I'd really love to talk to Derek Jeter or Mariano Rivera or Daryl Strawberry, and it's impossible. I could get Barack Obama on the phone before I could get anybody at the Derek Jeter Foundation to talk about what Trump gave them.
That says something right there. Does the Post on its website have a list of all the charities you've called and the responses that each charity has given?
Yes, we have a cool interactive graphic that we made sort of based on my notebook, but actually is like a searchable way to look at all the charities I've called and what they've said.
What's interesting is that you, a number of times you've tweeted out that you're keeping handwritten notes as to which charities you called and which charities and what they've responded. When I knew I was going to have you on, a good friend of mine, Peggy Lowe, is an award-winning reporter. She works for NPR in Kansas. She wanted me to ask you, was there any apprehension about putting your handwritten notes on the web?
Well, there was in one way. Our social media guru, the day that I started doing this in early June, I was like, yeah, I'm going to write down what I've done here. I'm going to write my notes out on this paper. I'm going to take a picture of it, post it online so people can sort of watch my futility in real time. And our social media guru was like, well, that's lame. Who wants to see a picture of a notebook? But I overruled him and did it anyway. And I was not worried that other media would see this and write a story off of it, just because there really hasn't been until pretty recently that much media following of the Trump charity story. And because most of what I'm posting is just when I don't succeed, you know, and almost all these answers, the answer is nobody, Trump gave them nothing. So there's not really much to be gleaned story-wise, or somebody could beat me with my own notes.
David, is there a larger takeaway that we as readers should have from your reporting on Trump and his charitable giving, or maybe charitable non-giving?
Yeah, I'm sort of working on the last summation story of Trump's charitable giving now. And what you learn about him is the way that he views, the way that he views charity, but really the way he views sort of the moral responsibility of his wealth. You know, a lot of people who make a lot of money become sort of conscious of the fact that they have so much more than other people, and they find a way to give back. And usually they find a way to give back in a way that sort of, you know, there's one or two abiding causes that they give to every year, a hospital, their alma mater, you know, a particular kind of children's charity. With Trump, that's not the guiding light you see. That's not the theme. The theme is Trump. And he uses charity as basically a way of helping himself by either directly by using a charity to buy things for himself, like pictures of himself or, you know, a Tim Tebow helmet, or to use his charity to build relationships that his businesses need. You know, one example I'm writing about now is there's this weird situation in New York in the 1990s where Trump gives the two biggest donations he gives in the 1990s are to this thing called the National Museum of Catholic Art and History, which is, it's a weird museum because it wasn't Catholic and it had no art. It was just a townhouse in East Harlem. And but the person who was the chairman of the board of that museum was a powerful guy in one of the building trades unions, and the building trades union's pension fund gave Trump's building loans. So this is a way of maintaining a relationship with that guy. There's no charitable gain because it's just a townhouse where the museum's director lives. Money paid for like jacuzzis. It didn't pay for Catholic art, but it's a way of maintaining this relationship that Trump needs for his business. That's the kind of thing that he uses charity for.
All right. I got a couple more here before we go to listener questions. You've obviously dealt now a lot with the Trump campaign. You're obviously calling them when you're working on these foundation stories. Their main campaign spokesperson described your reporting as like badgering, and I believe she said that she doesn't see it as journalism. Again, paid spokesperson for Donald Trump. How would and that was Kelly Conway, by the way, Kellyanne Conway. How would you describe your reporting, and how would you describe someone else's description of your reporting as badgering?
Well, I don't mind being called badgering, honestly. I mean, this is a guy who's like a major party nominee for the president of the United States. If he was Donald Trump game show host and I was this into his charitable giving, yeah, maybe that's badgering. But this is a guy who's running for president of the United States who's made philanthropy a big part of his public image. So I don't think it's in any way wrong to be obsessed or work really hard on that particular topic. The reporting, the way I describe it is, this is a rare time, and Trump is sort of an unusually non-transparent candidate. He doesn't tell you much about his business or his debts or his net worth or anything else. This is a way to like build an image of Trump out of negative space, right? By calling the people that he's promised help to, or that he's helped in the past, or that he could have helped, and using their opinions, you know, a lot of them, to build a ring around Trump and reflect something back on him. And I find it very valuable for that reason. And it's a rare time when you can use other people's, you know, you can actually find somebody else to fact check Trump.
David, what is the relationship now for you when you contact the Trump campaign? They are obviously well aware of your reporting, and I don't think it's a big leap for me to think that you are a major pain in the ass for them. So that said, they can handle you a number of ways. They can not return your calls anymore. They can maybe put some obstacles in front of you so that you can't get to them. They could spin other publications to say that, you know, whatever, you're a Hillary Clinton supporter and these are the reason you're doing these stories. So especially since the Access, I mean, you were doing the charitable stuff, but the Access Hollywood story, that game changed a lot of things. So what is your current relationship now with the Trump campaign? Are you still calling them for every one of these charitable stories that you do? And if so, what is their response or non-response to you?
Well, since the Access Hollywood, everything I've sent them has been not returned. I mean, they just haven't responded to me at all. Their responses have kind of gone back and forth. There are times when they have actually put somebody on the phone with me as a campaign spokesman to say something. The problem with that is the times when they've done that, that person has said, I can think of two major examples, that person has said something that turned out to be completely false. They put somebody on the phone to give a version of events that I later disproved. So I don't think that helps them. In general, they just don't respond at all, or they respond with like very terse comments, sort of decrying the reporting in general. I wish they were more responsive, because it may be that there are examples where Trump actually did give money to charity and that would help his case, would make him look better, and they haven't responded at all. It's such a contrast from the Clinton people, who overwhelm you. If you ever read about Clinton, you get tons and tons of phone calls and emails and all these people overwhelming you. With Trump, it's like shouting into a cave sometimes. I wish they were more responsive.
That's interesting. Has the frequency of the Clinton campaign to you specifically, have those conversations increased because they see a reporter who's doing this reporting, and I'm sure it's to their benefit to try to, you know, they should try to sort of ingratiate themselves with you?
I don't deal with them that much. I'm thinking back to a time before all this Trump charity stuff started, when I actually wrote directly about Hillary Clinton, and then you get a lot of interaction with them. In this case, you know, they have their own opposition researchers who have like suggested things from time to time. That's been a very, very small part of the stuff that I've ended up using. Most of what I found on my own. So I would say overall, the Clinton people have been less helpful or less eager to help than you would expect, than I would have expected.
David, have you specifically asked for an interview with Donald Trump? And if you have, what has been the campaign's response to you? Not a statement from him, but an actual one-on-one with him.
It's happened only once since I started writing about the charity, but I've asked other times. I've only actually been put on the phone with him once, and that was back in May. The flashback to the veterans issue, there was a question about whether Trump had actually given the $1 million to veterans that he said would come out of his own pocket. Corey Lewandowski, the campaign spokesman, called me one day in May and said Trump had given the money, but he wouldn't say where or when or to whom. Then a couple of days later, after we did some more checking, we found that that was false and Trump had not actually given any money at all. So he finally did give the money to one particular group, and he called me to tell me about it. And it was late at night, or you know, maybe it was after deadline, 7 or 8 o'clock at night, on one of these nights in May. And so we were talking about what he'd done. And I said, well, why did you give this money away now, 4 months after you said you'd originally given it? And he said, well, you know, I had to vet the group that I gave to. And I said, well, you had to vet them. This group gave you a big award at a black tie dinner at the Waldorf Astoria last year. Like, you really had to vet these people now? And he said, oh, yeah, that's true. And I said, well, did you just give this money now because I was asking about it? And he called me a nasty guy. I said, you're a really nasty guy. And the conversation was strange in that, like, I still had some factual questions I wanted to ask him. And so he would sort of insult me, and then I would just act like nothing happened and say, well, what about, you know, how much money did you give to this group? And then he would begin his answer in a normal tone. And then that answer would devolve into insults. And then we'd start again with another factual question. It was a really strange interview.
It's interesting because that I feel like that's parallel to And again, having lived in New York City most of my life, most of my adult life, I should say, I've seen Trump for many, many years up close. I think those of us who live here kind of know what Donald Trump is about. And what he's about historically is someone who both loves and loathes the press. And it seems like, or needs the press, or can't live without the press. And it seems like your conversation with him was sort of encapsulated that as well. He wants to insult you at the same time. He's keeping you on the phone as well.
Yeah, he's not hanging up. And he's not. He was never like, well, you're such a jerk, I'm not going to answer your question. He would answer the question factually and then go back to how ashamed I ought to be of myself.
Fascinating. And now Corey Lewandowski, of course, is a prominent CNN pundit. All right, let us move to questions that listeners had when I said you're going to be on this podcast. I mean, overwhelming response to people who have interest. I mean, forget about Vern Lundquist or Joe Buck, David. You're clearly more popular than these guys. What's more satisfying, exposing the truth or chasing down leads?
Well, I have to say, there is a great element of the scavenger hunt and the chase in these stories. I mean, obviously you like it, you like the final product and telling people something they didn't know about Trump, but what makes these stories particularly fun is kind of the chase. And but fun in that every time you find something, at least it's been my experience, you find something and that opens the door to something that's even sort of weirder, more interesting down the road. Just by chance, I thought I'd found something interesting, and actually you just get a clue that, wow, there's something even bigger. But it's funny, you can't let it distort your opinion, where sometimes the thing that I found hardest to get, the information that I had to work the hardest to get, I tend to treat that as the most important information, even if really it's not that important in the grand scheme of things. So that's what you need editors for, to say, I know you had to work for days to find this $10,000 portrait of Donald Trump, but there's something much bigger in this story, so that can't be the lead.
This was a really interesting question from a listener that I thought, as you've gotten more prominent on this beat, and I presume that means you've gotten more tips, how do you make sure you're not being misled while still taking every tip seriously?
That's a really good question. The good thing for me is on Trump charity stuff, I generally know the world of Trump's giving well enough that I can tell you whether something sounds plausible or not. But you sort of have to be on the lookout. In fact, this didn't happen to me, thank God, but it could have. One of my colleagues here at the Post recently got a tip that Trump, from somebody saying they had some very damaging information about Trump, something bad he'd done in the past. And so my colleague goes to meet this source at a Starbucks, and he sits down, and the person at the next table taps the reporter on the shoulder, and he says, actually, you can't sit there. And my colleague says, why? And he says, we're running a sting operation on a Washington Post reporter. He's going to be here any minute. You need to get out of that chair.
Oh, my God.
So that definitely is happening out there. And I'm trying to make sure that I'm not the victim of it. But I have to say, it hasn't happened to me yet. Sometimes tips are too hard to track down, or they're not on point. But I haven't had anybody sort of trying to hoax me that I've detected.
By the way, that is the worst sting operation in the history of mankind. They gave
they gave it away to the reporter.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah. Something out of like House of Cards or something crazy. Another good question. You could work for days, weeks, and months sort of unearthing these amazing facts, but not be ready to publish a story. So has it been frustrating at all when you find something out, but you have to still wait because one fact or one really interesting thing is just not enough for a story to publish in the Washington Post?
That is frustrating. Sometimes it's the opposite, actually. I mean, so it is frustrating. Like, that's sort of the stage I'm in now, where I found, for the next story, I found a lot of good anecdotes and good little details, but I need to go back and do some more stuff to sort of have the thematic conclusions that tie all those details together. And that is frustrating, but, you feel like you're at least building a better, a broader picture all the time. One problem I've had is that sometimes you find these really good details and I want to just break them on their own. Like, for instance, when I found out that Trump had spent $20,000 of the foundation's money to buy this 6-foot-tall portrait of himself, I was like, oh, my God, this is great. I got to write this right away. And the editors were like, no, don't be stupid. You have a bigger story coming out in 2 days. Take that good detail and use it to make the bigger story better so that you now draw people into a much longer story. That's been sort of, I think my impulse has been in the opposite direction. I've been kind of reined in by the editors.
Interesting. Is there a particular editor that you want to cite who has really been a sounding board or someone that has always seen these pieces before they've published?
Sure. Steven Ginsburg is my editor. And he and I have worked together for a long time on a bunch of different stuff. But on these stories, he just is really good at, my problem is that I'm way down in the weeds on all these stories. And it all sounds interesting to me, but I have trouble like figuring what will interest a layperson and what a new layperson will find new or not new. And he's been really good at keeping that sort of 30,000-foot view and helping me sort of pull back and see it myself.
I had a question about from a listener about has the IRS commented on any of your reporting? Have there been any statements on Trump Foundation filings?
Their policy is not to comment on any taxpayer information or any investigation until it's over. And so, or even to confirm that that investigation exists. So I've reached out to them a couple of times sort of as a pro forma thing, but, you know, I'm sure they're going to give me nothing every time.
Again, you know, a question, it's not fun to ask, but it's the reality of today in 2016. Have you felt like you've had to take any extra security precautions for yourself, for your family, while reporting on information that clearly a lot of people have interest in, and there are probably some people who don't like you reporting it?
Yes, definitely. That's something that I, you know, have taken a lot of precautions in the last couple of weeks. But honestly, my situation, because I don't travel that much, I don't really travel at all. I'm mostly just based here in D.C. You know, the threat that's out there for me, I think, is really, really tiny compared to the threat that, you know, people face who go out and cover these rallies, especially TV reporters who are very visible. I think if, you know, that's where the sort of greatest danger is, just because Trump is focusing people at the rallies on the media who is right there next to them.
Have you talked to any of your fellow Washington Post colleagues who are traveling on the road with the Trump campaign, and have they given you any insight into just how scary it is, at least lately?
I haven't talked to anybody lately. I talked to people back when we were banned. You know, for a long time, the Washington Post wasn't allowed to sit in the press pen at Trump events. We weren't, you know, they had to go in sort of in the regular people line. The reports I got from my colleagues was actually that the people who were with them in line were always nice, and, you know, there was never any trouble with the folks in line. But that what Trump would often do would be he would invite many more people than the venue would hold, and then not tell people if they were, you know, there's a way to figure out, well, you know, if you're beyond this point, you're not going to get in. They wouldn't do that. And so my colleague Jenna Johnson would often wait with these other people who were Trump fans in line for like 8 hours in the sun, and then get to the front of the line and be told, oh, there's no more room. And when she got in, nobody ever bothered her. But I think that was the most frustrating, was just that she was treated like any other Trump fan.
Interesting. Do the data journalists in your shop mock your notes and suggest you use Excel?
They have. I mean, I do have to confess to using Google Docs to track some of this stuff. And that actually, it's not, I hate to call it data journalism because I'm not actually doing anything sophisticated with it. It's just a good way of organizing my notes. But I do actually, I really have used Google Spreadsheets and Google Docs extensively to make sure that I'm keeping track of all the stuff that I'm looking at. So I have been mocked, but they know that the handwritten notes it's a backup and it's an illustration. If it's not my only source of information, because God, if I spilled coffee on that, it was all I had, I'd be in big trouble.
You mentioned your editor. Do you have any researcher or assistant, or is there a web producer that's sort of assigned to your work?
So I have there's a researcher, Alice Kreitz, who's our amazing national researcher, and so she's done a lot of stuff, especially trying to hunt down transcripts of the Celebrity Apprentice things, and I was trying to track Trump's promises on that show. And then the Daniel Rindler, who is the designer who made that great display of my notes, tracking all the people I've called so people can look at it online. And then Terry Rupar has been she's the web producer for the national staff, and it's helped me with a lot of things.
You a number of people asked this question. After this is all over, the election is complete, do you have plans to write a book on Trump's charitable giving?
I think I'd like to. I don't know if people are going to really care that much after the election, but it'd be fun for me. I'm going to try to write a magazine story for the Post magazine after this is over with, and maybe that will give me a sense of, A, if I like writing about this experience, and B, if anybody cares.
All right, a couple more here. This must have been asked by a wrestling fan, but has your reporting led you to surmise anything about the relationship between Donald Trump and the McMahons, Vince and Linda?
That's a great question, and it is probably the most frustrating thing I have not figured out. So the biggest donation in the history of the Trump Foundation comes from Vince and Linda McMahon, $4 million in 2007, which is right after Trump was on WrestleMania. And the McMahons have said nothing about why they gave. In fact, Linda McMahon said recently that she couldn't remember why she'd given $4 million. it's just writing a check and you forget about it. It seems like it's related in some way to Trump's appearances on WrestleMania and subsequent wrestling events, but I have no idea more. There's definitely something more there, and I just don't know what it is.
I love the fact that, like, the McMahons and the WWE, that's like your white whale right now, basically.
It's true. There were a couple of things I thought I'd never figure out that I have figured out now, and that's the last thing I haven't gotten.
All right, two more here. How many subscriptions does he think he personally sold? How many digital subscriptions have you sold, David? Do you know?
We've had some of our, I don't know how many I would take credit for personally, but I'll figure that out before my next salary evaluation. but we've had our biggest subscription days in history, digital subscription days in history, the last few days, especially after that Access Hollywood day.
I knew I was going to ask you this because people wanted me to ask you, but I'm not even honestly sure how to ask it because it's such a self-serving, weird question. But I mean, do you allow yourself at all to think about awards for the kind of reporting you do? I know for a fact you're not doing this to win awards because no journalist sets out to be like, oh, I'm going to win an award for the story I'm starting to report on. But the fact is it's out there and people talk about it. And I'm sure that's flattering to you. But have you allowed yourself at all to sort of think about that, the kind of your report, the reporting that you have done has been mentioned in journalism circles as potentially award winning?
Which is awesome. I mean, I try not to think about it because it's still not done. You know, I feel like there's 3 more weeks that I don't want to get lulled into thinking like, oh, I've already done such great stuff. I don't have to try that hard now, just because it's going to be over before I know it. I don't know. I hesitate to even think about it, just because I don't want to count chickens before they're hatched, and especially before the election's over.
And my final thing for you, David, is, don't you think you owe it to yourself to ask the Washington Post sports editor as a break from all this to cover Astro spring training, maybe for like a week even or something like that?
Wouldn't that be amazing? I think I want to wait till they move into their new place. I don't want to go to Kissimmee. I want to go to the new place. But yeah, it'd be so much fun. You know, I was to say about sports writing. One of the great things about sports writing lately is how people have gotten the writing and the commentating on TV has gotten so much more knowledgeable about the mechanics of the game.
Right. Analytics,
you know,
the
change from like John Madden to Chris Collinsworth. I mean, think about that, where John Madden would just like make a loud noise and pound his fist into something to illustrate something. And, the way people have learned to try to explain the complexities of sports. I hope that in politics reporting, we're doing more of that now, where it's not just me telling you, Al Gore looked good on that stage, you know, or I like to have a beer with that guy, you know, actually telling you a little bit more about how these operations work and also like bringing in the like fact-checking element into the stories themselves.
Do you, last one, I'm sorry for asking this, but or saying I had no more, but I do have one more. Do you take this stuff home with you? And or when you go home, and I don't know what your marital status is or is not, but or do you separate it? Like the Trump Foundation reporting is what you do from these certain hours, and then when that's done, you walk away and you're kicking back, you're having a beer, you're watching, you know, sort of soap operas. You're not dealing with any of this stuff. Like, is it 24/7 for you, or is there really like a demarcation where there's a work you and there's a non-work you?
I mean, lately it's been 24 hours a day. I have a family, and I think I see them sometimes, and try not to think about Donald Trump's foundation. But you know, my 4-year-old the other day at dinner started giving us a long treatise on the Trump Foundation and what her opinion of it was. Just because I think it's all she's heard me talk about for weeks at a time. She thinks she knows it's important. She wants to have an opinion. So yes, I have. That's what's made me look even more forward to November 9th, because it's been so intense. But I tell myself, okay, it's okay that it's intense, because it's going to end eventually.
Tell the Post to hire that 4-year-old as a research assistant. I like it.
Her opinions are very trenchant.
David Farenthold is a reporter for the Washington Post. He was gracious enough to join us today on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. You've obviously followed his work on Trump's charitable giving. He was the person for the Post who broke the Access Hollywood tape story, which I think game changed this election. And I can't recommend him enough as someone whose work you should be reading at the Washington Post. He alone, not just him. I mean, it's an amazing paper, but he's worth the digital subscription right now. You should also follow him on Twitter as well. Listen, David, I know you're a busy person, and this is a sports media podcast, not a political reporting podcast. You did not have to do this, but I appreciate it, and I think the listeners will appreciate it as well. Thank you very much for joining us on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Hey, thank you.
All right, back in the studio to wrap up. My thanks to David Farenthold for a terrific conversation. I really appreciate his time. He's a busy guy, and very cool of him to give us an hour. I want to thank, of course, everybody at Digital Media, including my producer, Lou Pellegrino. Thank you for the support of Uber. They support this podcast. We absolutely support them. My thanks to everybody at Sports Illustrated who's on the podcast group, from Ben Eagle to Chris Stone, John Wertheim, etc. Got some really good podcasts coming up for you guys to listen to, including Elliot Friedman of Hockey Night in Canada. I think you're going to enjoy that. Until then, we'll see you next time on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.